This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Globally, according to Johns Hopkins University, approximately 286,000 people have died from COVID-19, and the number of infections approaches 4.2 million. In the United States, the death toll is more than 80,000 people with 1.3 million confirmed infections. U.S. President Donald Trump insisted Monday his administration has met the moment and prevailed on coronavirus testing, even as the White House itself became a potent symbol of the risk facing Americans everywhere by belatedly ordering everyone who enters the West Wing to wear a mask. Mr. Trump addressed a Rose Garden audience filled with mask-wearing administration officials, some appearing publicly with face coverings for the first time during the pandemic, after two aides tested positive for COVID-19 late last week. The startling sight served only to further highlight the challenge the president faces in instilling confidence in a nation still reeling from that pandemic. A new type of coronavirus test offers a cheaper, quicker way to screen for infections, moving the U.S. toward the kind of mass screening that experts say is essential to returning millions of Americans to school and work. The first so-called antigen test announced Saturday by the Food and Drug Administration is not quite the kind sought by government of health officials. It is less accurate than the current gold standard for testing and can only be run on specialized equipment. It is too early to tell, said lab researcher Patricia Simner of Johns Hopkins University, assessing its impact. New report says that New York City's death toll from the coronavirus may be thousands of fatalities worse than the official tally kept by the city and state. The analysis released Monday by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that between mid-March and early May, about 24,000 more people died in the city than researchers would ordinarily expect. This is VOA News. The White House is recommending that all nursing home residents and staff be tested for the coronavirus in the next 2 weeks. Vice President Mike Pence, who leads the White House Coronavirus Task Force, told governors on a video conference call Monday that it's the federal government's strong recommendation that such testing be done. Dr. Deborah Birx, the task force coordinator, told governors to focus over the next 2 weeks on testing all 1 million nursing home residents. She says the White House will help states that need it. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson set out a cautious plan on Monday to focus on how the UK's lockdown measures would slowly be lifted. The government published a 51-page document outlining the strategy that includes a staged reopening of businesses and advice on public transport and wearing face coverings, as well as a 14-day quarantine for most international arrivals. Speaking in Parliament, Johnson said the government would not be hasty in removing restrictions. The United Kingdom has one of the world's highest official COVID-19 death tolls, and after criticism that he was slow to order a lockdown, Johnson is concerned by the prospect of a second wave of infection. He's also been accused of putting out confusing advice on the new strategy. A new outbreak of coronavirus cases in South Korea has sent officials scrambling to stop its spread in the densely populated capital city of Seoul. Officials reported over 30 new infections across the country as of midnight Sunday, the highest daily numbers in more than a month. The country had been lauded for its early action in slowing the pandemic, but on Sunday, the president, Moon Jae-in, warned of a second wave. Twitter announced Monday it will start alerting users when a tweet makes disputed or misleading claims about the coronavirus. The new rule is the latest of a wave of stricter policies that tech companies are rolling out to confront an outbreak of virus-related misinformation on their sites. Facebook and Google, which owns YouTube, have already put similar systems in place. That announcement signals that Twitter is taking its role in amplifying misinformation more seriously, but how the platform enforces its new policy will be the real test, with company leaders already tamping down expectations. More than 200 people were arrested in Hong Kong during pro-democracy protests across the city Sunday after a sing-along demonstration at a shopping mall spilled out onto the streets. Firing pepper pellets and clearing out protesters, Hong Kong authorities arrested more than the 200 people during the protest. Hundreds of riot police were deployed to disperse protesters across the city as protesters chanted for freedom and held up banners calling for revolution. It's one of the first signs of civil unrest returning to Hong Kong, which has largely been put on hold by social distancing restrictions. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A rights group petitions the courts to bar the Malawi Election Commission from administering the July 2nd election.
It will give us ample time to recruit new commissioners, train them at least within a week or two, and empower them with the processes that the current MEC has been handling. So obviously by 2nd of July, they will be in a better position to run the affairs of an election.
Lesotho awaits a new government following the collapse of Prime Minister Thabane's government. South Africans say they are tired of 7 weeks of COVID-19 restrictions. Ugandan President Museveni talks 2021 elections with coronavirus on his mind. And COVID-19 challenges for pregnant women in Kenya.
Immediately I came out of the theater, I remembered we are living at COVID-19 times. So I had to protect my baby for the 3 to 4 days we were going to be there.
Liberia's information minister is discharged from COVID-19 restrictions with a message. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Malawi Human Rights Consultative Commission has petitioned a high court seeking to bar the leadership of the Electoral Commission from organizing the July presidential election rerun. Robert Nkwezelemwa, executive director of the HRCC, says Electoral Commission Chairperson Justice J. Ansa and the other commissioners failed to organize credible elections, resulting in a constitutional court annulment of the 2019 presidential poll results. Meanwhile, Electoral Commission officials say they will continue to work until their contract expires. But Rabo Nkwezelemwa tells viewers Peter Clotty that two court rulings have determined the electoral officials incompetent and therefore should not be allowed to administer another election.
Yes, exactly, about on four grounds. Firstly, is to do with MEC's failure to address the issue of registration of children underage. Secondly, is to do with the likelihood of having the data by MEC not as tight as possible, owing to external players accessing the data bank. Thirdly, the issue of COVID-19, we are not satisfied with the measures that MEC is putting in place. Violence that is politically motivated to an extent that the monitors and the registration officers have been beaten or hacked, giving it clearly that MEC is failing to control the situation. But over and above that is the MEC's competence, which has been confirmed by the Supreme Court, the Constitutional Court, as well as Public Affairs Committee of Parliament.
But Robert, the Electoral Commission leadership contract ends in June, so why not allow the process to resolve itself out?
The challenge with waiting for the process to resolve itself is that where they're living, a normal process also has to follow. So they have to leave exactly at the time that they're supposed to leave. And obviously the process has to start to replace them with new commissioners. And that may take 1 month or so. So if it's May, if it's June, you are talking of less than 30 days to 2nd July. Whereas if it is done today, it will give us ample time to recruit new commissioners, train them at least within a week or two, and empower them with the processes that the current MEC has been handling. So obviously by 2nd of July, they will be in a better position to run the affairs of an election, as opposed to us waiting for June, and then when they retire or leave their offices, we have to start hunting afresh. So this is why we feel it's right and proper that we do it now. The Supreme Court made it clear the 150 days were generous. It should have been 60 days. So any loss of day may bring this mistrust on the part of the electorate.
Robert, what do you say to critics who say that your move to petition the court to bar the current leadership of the Electoral Commission from organizing the election is just a mere publicity stunt, just to draw attention to yourself and to make your group relevant?
Well, that's funny. We don't need to get any publicity. We have been around. People have seen us. We have always been objective. All our statements, all our issues have been straight to the point. No need for us to gain any mileage on the ground. Just look at the essence of the matter. It's just the right thing to do because all these political parties have cried of the same issues. You talk of DPP, MCP, UDF, UTM, as well as the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, the Transformation movement, which has just been formed of Comrade Timothy Ntambo. They have said all these issues, but our argument and our motivation is the fact that no one seemed to have listened. The only movement should be through the courts because the authorities have made it clear they are not firing the MEC. MEC commissioners have also challenged, they are not resigning. And we are saying the only solution is to go to court because demonstrations will not help us. We have had them 9 months, nothing has happened. So perhaps the courts should be quick to help us in this regard. So it's not about us gaining any popularity. We have always established ourselves since 1995.
Robert Nkwezalemuad is the executive director of the Malawi Human Rights Consultative Commission. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Lilongwe. The people of Lesotho are awaiting the formation of a new government following the collapse Monday of embattled Prime Minister Thomas Thabane's coalition government. The Prime Minister's own party, the All Basotho Convention Party, joined with two other members of the four-party coalition to doom the ruling coalition. Motelentwa Lepsa, deputy leader of Lesotho's opposition Democratic Congress Party, says this paves the way for the formation of a new government sometime around May 22nd.
The coalition forming government has collapsed. A new coalition is taking over in a matter of few days.
Now that the government has collapsed, what is supposed to happen next?
The new coalition partners have to meet and choose the leader, which they have already done, and give the name to the speaker, who will then send it to the Council of State, where the king is the chairperson, for them to appoint as the prime minister.
Will there be a caretaker government, or do you already have someone to succeed Prime Minister Thomas Thabane?
There is somebody who is already elected to succeed Prime Minister Thabane. Between today and the 22nd of May, a new government will be in place. Those days are reserved for the leaving of office by the prime minister and his ministers and coming in of the new prime minister and his new ministers.
What role do you expect your party will play in the new government?
We are going to do everything in our power to make sure that the needs of the poor people, the needs of all Basotho, are addressed. We are going to level the ground for growth of businesses, small, medium, and large businesses. We are going to make sure that we strive for job creation and we make sure that we promote entrepreneurial skills among youth so that they don't look up to the government or big businesses only to hire them. So basically, we are going to make sure that people get the best out of the resources of Lesotho. Rule of law is one key factor. We have been complaining about police brutality, breakdown of rule of law in Lesotho, interference with the courts of law, and so many other things. So we are going to make sure that things go back to normal so that there is rule of law and there is economic activity going on.
Motelentwa Lepsa is the deputy leader of Lesotho's opposition Democratic Congress Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Maseru. In Mali's central region of Mopti, the UN mission known as MINUSMA still has no helicopter base in the area, so it uses military helicopters and more aircraft from the north to protect civilians heavily targeted in the Mopti region. This limits the mission's ability to respond quickly to the present need to prevent attacks on civilians, says Sean Smith, author of the report Protecting Civilians in Mali, Why Air Access Matter for MINUSMA.
People at the mission in Mopti told me during my research that, yeah, there have been cases where somebody, either a local mayor or a member of civil society, has contacted the mission, warning them that armed groups are, an armed group is outside a village and has threatened to attack a village, and the mission doesn't have the helicopter based there to be able to respond. Now, the mission does obviously have ground troops as well, but not very many. Trying to get there very quickly is almost impossible. They're often doing other tasks as well, so the ground troops are very stretched. Mm-hmm. And it's not always possible for them to deploy or to travel immediately or particularly quickly. The most effective means to respond to an imminent attack is simply not present.
With this need, why are there no helicopters in the Mopti region to respond to this increasing need to protect civilians?
So when MINUSMA was initially established, its priority was to help broker and implement a peace accord in the north of the country. In 2013, when MINUSMA deployed to Mali, Mopti was relatively stable and calm. The Security Council has adapted the mandate to reflect the evolving security dynamics, but the resources have been slow to catch up. So there was meant to be a helicopter detachment from Senegal based in the Mopti region, but when Senegal deployed that, it ended up being it didn't have the helicopter unit. They have authorized budget for that, but no member state has so far come forward to contribute that asset to the mission.
When you say that there no member state has come forward with that, you know, how many states is that? What kind of a range of states is that? And why do we think that is?
So when I say member states, I should be more precise. I should say UN member state, any of the members of the UN.
Well, and speaking of different nations and different contributions, what role is the Malian military and the Malian government playing?
Yeah, clearly in MINUSMA's mandate, the MINUSMA is there to support the Malian authorities to reduce intercommunal violence in the center and to protect civilians. MINUSMA should not be the primary actor when it comes to protecting civilians in central Mali or throughout Mali. It should be the Malian state. However, the Malian forces are often ill-equipped or incapable. And so it often falls to MINUSMA to try to intervene to protect civilians. The Malian armed forces have faced a number of devastating attacks over the past 6 or 9 months. And so the strategy has changed from being present in their bases along the border, and there have been more consolidation in more protected camps because the FAMA have suffered so many bad attacks.
That was Sean Smith, author of the report Protecting Civilians in Mali, Why Air Assets Matter for MINUSMA. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from the United Kingdom. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 12. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni says the country can go ahead and organize the national elections expected early next year if the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic is contained in time. But one analyst says the elections, if held, will be easily in favor of the president, who has had enough media airtime during the COVID-19 crisis. Mugumi Davis Rakaringi reports from Kampala.
President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni told local television NBS in an interview broadcast this Monday evening that his government is still on track to hold general elections expected in February next year. But he says it would be what he calls total madness to have elections if there is still COVID-19 in the country.
If the virus can stop like around June, we can have elections. What's the problem? If it stops like in June or what? We don't have to have a long campaign time. We don't have to. Of course, if it doesn't, it's very dangerous. People gather, it's very dangerous. So if it can stop the virus, we can control it around June, even July. Elections are not a big issue. We can organize quickly.
Harold Kaija, the spokesperson of Forum for Democratic Change, Uganda's biggest opposition party, says elections should go ahead as planned despite the COVID-19 pandemic.
You cannot put our people in care and think you're going to manage this disease. I've seen more people dying in this country, in this period. And you've not seen anybody dying of COVID. So, we must say, how do we manage the new normal?
Joel Senyony, the spokesperson of People Power Movement, a political pressure group headed by popular musician and politician Robert Chagrani, also known as Bobi Wine, says some politicians are simply being selfish, discussing postponing elections when people are struggling with effects of coronavirus disease.
When you say let's push elections to 2023 because of COVID, you are in essence telling them you're going to continue suffering, the children won't go back to school till 2023, businesses won't reopen till 2023, you're going to keep serving till 2023, which is very problematic. That some of our politicians are that selfish. That for them, they're only concerned about keeping in their positions, earning a paycheck, and of course, you know, using taxpayers' money and all of that, and depriving Ugandans of a chance to really determine who gets to govern them.
Should the COVID-19 pandemic persist beyond July and elections are postponed, Uganda lost its plate that a Speaker of Parliament temporarily takes over the presidency when the current term of office expires next year. A scenario, political analyst Charles Romshana says he does not see happening in Uganda.
Therefore, he will go for a system where the urban areas which are hard hit by COVID, that is Kampala, Wakiso, and parts of Bukono, in any case where he has even problems, you will lock them out, like the way the Democratic Republic of the Congo locked out the Kivu, North Kivu and South Kivu. They did not support. And you have a president who was not elected by the whole of Kivu. So you can now have a president here in Uganda who is not elected by Kampala, Jinja, mainly the other areas. And you would still call it an election.
Some activities on the electoral calendar, like elections for people with special needs that were expected to be held last month, have already been postponed because of the coronavirus pandemic. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
South Africa is entering a seventh week of restrictions in an attempt to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Top officials say the measures have made a difference in transmission, but critics are calling for them to end more quickly, saying the restrictions are now themselves a burden on a population which has long struggled with inequality, poverty, and unemployment. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
To say South Africa is tired of the lockdown would be a gross understatement. Officials acknowledge the effect that a curfew and limitations on movement are having on the population's financial and mental health, but say they are holding firm against a bigger health threat, that of a virus that has killed 3.2% of those known to be infected in the World Health Organization's African region. The global death rate is about 7%, according to WHO statistics. The head of the opposition Democratic Alliance, John Steenhuisen, threw these provocative words at the ruling African National Congress.
We're no longer dealing with a COVID-19 crisis. We are dealing with a lockdown crisis, an ANC lockdown crisis, to be precise. Let me be very clear. There is no longer a justification to keep this hard lockdown in place. They cannot do this because they don't seem to know for sure themselves.
The initial five-week hard lockdown, which has now been replaced by slightly loosened restrictions, was aimed at buying the health system time to prepare for an inevitable wave of infections. Critics argue that that time is up, and that the harm done to livelihoods outweighs the risks faced by easing the restrictions. Most of the country is currently under what is known as Phase 4 of the eased lockdown, with a nighttime curfew and reduced shopping hours in place. The sale of alcohol and cigarettes remains illegal. Although several key sectors of the economy have gone back to work, many South Africans remain at home, unable to do so. Shabir Mahdi, professor of vaccinology at the University of the Witwatersrand, urged more targeted testing and screening, and huge improvements to water and sanitation. The lockdowns, he said, aren't enough.
And if we can't do that, unfortunately, what we're setting up ourselves for, irrespective of what policy government has, right? If we're not able to abide by those sort of conditions, if we can't create an environment for people to actually practice those sort of interventions, we're going to have a much quicker rate of transmission of the virus, and we're going to get a surge much sooner, and the peak with this wave probably will be much greater than we expect.
At this time, the government is holding firm in its positions. Over the weekend, Health Minister William Kiza noted an alarming rise in new infections in the Western Cape and threatened that the nation may see a return to a total lockdown or heightened interventions of various forms in some areas where transmission is high. Steenhuisen opposes that.
The real tragedy playing out here is no longer the coronavirus, but the lockdown itself, because this lockdown is going to cost many more lives than it can possibly save.
President Cyril Ramaphosa has yet to say publicly when the restrictions might end. But in his Monday newsletter, the president said the nation was stepping up its testing, screening, and treatment regime. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Pregnant women in Kenya have abandoned public hospitals and now seek help from midwives and personal gynecologists. This is due to the COVID-19 outbreak that has led to Kenyans seeking healthcare services in public and private hospitals to keep away from the facilities for fear of contracting the virus. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, maternal mortality is still the leading cause of deaths among women in Kenya.
At least 362 women die for every 100,000 live births in Kenya. This is according to Kenya Demographic Survey that says most maternal mortality are due to home delivery and complications arising during pregnancy. Christine Kimani is 7 months pregnant of her first child. She says most of the facilities she used to go for her clinics are no longer accommodating her for fear of COVID-19, and she now pays to be offered services by a personal gynecologist.
They are regulating the flow of people in and out of hospitals. Thus, it becomes really difficult to access medical care being a pregnant person. It's even easier and safer to see a gynecologist because the gynecologist can regulate the number of people getting in and out of the clinic. Hence, it's safer.
Before the COVID-19 outbreak, the country's referral system for pregnant mothers was not in a good state. Lydia Opio gave birth a week ago, but for her, it's her second baby. She says most of the women at the facility were hesitant and scared of the newborn babies contracting the virus.
The fear of COVID-19 in the hospital is real. In a hospital setting, whether there's a case there or not, from the gates you sanitize, your temperature measures are taken. Immediately I came out of the theater, I remembered we are living at COVID-19 times. So I had to protect my baby for the 3 to 4 days we were going to be there. It was a difficult job, but I had to do it.
Lucy Mushiri, a midwife who offers door-to-door services, said that most of her clients prefer to be attended to at home than going to hospitals. Yesterday, Monday, Kenya recorded 28 more COVID-19 cases, bringing the number of those infected with the virus to 700. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Liberian Information Minister Eugene Nabwe, who 2 weeks ago began a COVID-19 isolation, was discharged yesterday, Monday. He discusses his treatment and the lessons for all Liberians about COVID-19.
My experience was one of mixed emotions. Yeah, I was an official of government who had been at the forefront of advocating and pushing and encouraging Liberians and all of the residents in the country to adhere to the measures. I myself had been tested positive. But my main concern was about my family, my friends, and all of those who I had come in contact with. So once I got at the treatment center, my first priority was to work with the epidemiologist so that we could try to trace my contacts. We succeeded in doing that to a very large extent. And most of those who I came in contact with, including my wife, my daughter, my son, and all of the other persons were tested. Apart from my assistant, the rest of them came back negative. So I proceeded to receive the treatment.
What sort of treatment did you get? I'm asking this question because we know that your president, George Weah, took delivery of the purported Madagascar COVID-19 medicine. Did you get some while in isolation?
It was really a cocktail of treatments, like selenium, vitamin C, vitamin D, and I also took in a lot of fish oil and fish caviar. They also administer some antibiotics, including erythromycin, because the determination was that corona attacks the lungs and there is pneumonia-like infection and inflammation that comes about. So they deal with that through antibiotics.
A number of senior Liberian government officials, including yourself, have tested positive, raising the concern about President George Weah. Is there any concern on your part as you prepare to return to work?
There's absolutely no worry about the health of the president, because it has been determined that Mr. President continues to remain very healthy, and he is leading the charge against the virus.
That was Liberian Information Minister Eugene Nambu speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. And that's it for this Tuesday, May 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a great day.